96.3 FM Ohm Radio Charleston. I'm Whitney Powers, and I'm your host today for the series Small Talks, Big Ideas, a weekly half-hour to an hour-long show that is a collaborative space shared by some of our community's active advocacy organizations, including Lowcountry Local First, Coastal Conservation League, and If You Were Mayor. And while these organizations serve different needs in our community, they are largely aligned in their vision for the future. So Small Talks, Big Ideas is a space for each of these organizations to share their ideas, have tough but necessary conversations, and invite you as listeners into our work. For today's segment, we welcome Jeremy Rutledge, senior pastor of Circular Congregational Church and an active voice in the Charleston Area Justice Ministry and the Quality Education Project, among others. And today we're here to talk about building communities that are equitable and just. And as an aside, at the If You Were Mayor website, our categories of community building key off of five particular areas: transportation, neighborhoods, parks, and affordable housing, education, economic opportunities, and arts and culture. And I think our discussion today will venture into a number of these areas, probably merged in many ways. And so it's very relevant to the big picture that we try to sort of promote on our website. So hello, Jeremy.
Hello.
And welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Whitney. And also thanks to Ohm Radio for hosting such an important community space and dialogue over the airwaves.
Well, great. Well, I just want to clarify for the listeners that we are, in fact, two white people who are here to have a conversation that explores issues of race, inequity, and justice, and not necessarily faith, per se. There are certainly important figures in the African-American community here. Reverend Joseph Darby comes to mind, who might give us more insight into specific concerns and issues that exist within this group. And that's certainly a conversation that we hope to have. But this is, in fact, a conversation that I see as something of a bridge to that one. I reached out to you, someone I believe who serves as a bridge here, and so that you might share some of the possibilities you've discovered and cultivated for building trust and in fostering a kind of healing in terms of race and inequality in the Lowcountry. I want to also point out that I deliberately use the word bridge, because I like to think that our charge here is about connecting rather than isolating communities. And hopefully that makes sense. And I know that you haven't been in Charleston very long. You moved here from Houston, where you had a ministry that I understand also forged ties with the African-American community. And I would assume that that's played a role in your path to Charleston. But would you mind giving us a bit more insight into your background and how that is, how that thread got from point A to point B, meaning
right.
Charleston?
Okay, thanks. Well, you know, just speaking about Houston, it occurred to me that I've lived about a third of my life in Houston, and that was the city of my mother, and it was the city of my grandparents, so there are a lot of roots there. In some ways, it reminds me of Charleston because it's a southern city. It's a bayou city. When you sort of walk around the city and it feels similar, there are live oaks and azaleas and magnolias, and this sort of culturally, there are some similarities. But in other ways, that city is very, very different. It's about 4 million people. It's very cosmopolitan. An old friend, Steven Kleinberg at Rice University, who was a sociologist and sort of did the demographics of Houston, like to talk about it as a city with no ethnic majority. It's a really up-and-coming American city, and he says, you know, with a little luck, all of our cities will look like this in 100 years. There's a real cultural and ethnic and diversity and a vitality to that city. So I have a soft spot for the city of Houston. Having said that, it's also a city with extraordinary traffic and gentrification. And the middle class is collapsing, and the price of everything is going up. People are getting pushed out of places where they've always lived. So you can also hear some similarities maybe with our city in that way. But Houston has always been, I think, a part of where I'm coming from. Something even more formative for me was the city where I was born, or the place where I was born. And I was born in Hawaii, born in the city of Honolulu, and grew up over the mountains from there. And that was really my best experience with pluralism. Again, there was no ethnic majority, and it was a great place to be a kid. But also, more relevantly, I think, it was 1971. It was
Hawaii 5-0.
Right. Well, and I didn't even know about that. What I knew about was the Vietnam War was raging.
Right.
And the religious community that we were a part of, about half of the community were active service members, and they were going off to the war and getting killed. And about half the community were Vietnamese refugees who were fleeing the war.
Wow.
And trying to get resettled. My parents became very involved in this just because it was the place where they were. And it was
right.
the thing that was happening. And I remember that vividly, you know, my parents' objection to the war because of the harm it did to all sides.
Right.
And vividly this conviction that we should be involved in helping everybody. And so they were, I think, building their own kind of bridge, although they didn't set out to do it. They just showed up somewhere and saw what was going on, and they weren't going to sit to the
it
side.
It was coincidental to the time and place, and they weren't going to sit beside and watch things happen. They
right, right. And I think that formed me. We
sure.
showed up in Charleston 4 years ago, and then you say, well, what's happening here, and how can we help? So,
well, that's pretty cool. I think that's something we should all aspire to in our own way. I know from experience at Circular Church that your theological interests include, and this is going to, I'm going to kind of getting to the point here. Your theological interests include a type of narrative storytelling that connects day-to-day experiences with spiritual, ethical, and philosophical matters. And I think this is an interesting and, frankly, formidable skill that I applaud you for possessing and envy at a certain extent. Maybe not in the sinful way, but I do have that envy. That particularly brings to mind Brian Stevenson, who was here recently at the College of Charleston. He's the founder of Alabama's Equal Justice Initiative, for those of you who don't know. And he spoke of the four steps to healing the racial divide in that particular speech. And three of them, having proximity, maintaining hope, and recognizing discomfort in the process, were actually topped out by the fourth, which I think is part of our discussion today, and you have a flair for it. It was really changing the narrative, and I wonder if this idea of storytelling and the narrative process, if you can share with us maybe how that has informed some of your work in this sort of racial injustice or inequality sort of facet or sphere, I guess is the right word.
Well, I think that storytelling is key. And I would think that in a certain sense because I'm a literature major. I would think that in a certain sense because I'm a minister and we tell the same stories over and over for thousands of years, you know. But I also think that we're just storytelling creatures. You know, we come home and meet our family or friends and we say, how was your day? And we don't give a list of things we did. We tell a story. Oh, you won't believe what happened, or this happened, or that happened, and we're shaped by stories. When it comes to origin stories and founding stories, I was fascinated when I arrived at Charleston at the story that was told to me by the carriage operators and the tour companies. You know, there was this romanticized antebellum South. Isn't this lovely? Isn't this wonderful story? And I couldn't help thinking as soon as I got here about all the people who were brought here against their will, about the beginning of the Civil War, about the sort of, I could almost feel it in the air, this sort of heaviness. That's not putting it strongly enough. I thought, I was walking around trying to figure out what actually happened here, trying to absorb that, and it was glossed over. You know, it was, and I was looking for it. I knew it had happened. And I'll come around to a little bit more about storytelling, but my first experience in Charleston, my first day here, first time I had ever been, I was walking around downtown, as you do, and I was seeing all the carriages and the historic churches and the beautiful old buildings of Rainbow Row and every other place. And I just kept walking. I didn't know where I was. And I was going, I guess, from the Cooper side to the Ashley side.
Right.
Which I couldn't have even told you at the time. And I was walking, and there were all these carriages and four-star restaurants and tourists, almost all of whom were white. And I'm walking, and I'm walking. And then all of a sudden, I think I was probably around Beaufain or something. I didn't know at the time. And I walked right through the middle of a housing project. And it went from all white people.
Beaufain, by the way.
Oh, I beg your pardon. See, I was still learning. I went from all white people to several blocks of all black people. And there were some boys playing soccer or something in the street, some young African-American boys. And I said hello to them, and they ran away. Like, it was cartoonish. And then I kept walking, and then it was all white people again.
Right.
And I kind of had to pinch myself and think, what just happened? Well, that's part of my story of being introduced to Charleston.
Right.
There's a First Nations, a Native American ethicist from Canada named Thomas King, who I rely on a lot. And he talks about storytelling and ethics. And he asks, do you want a different ethic? Then tell a different story. And I think I worry that the story we're telling about Charleston, that it's genteel and that it's lovely and that that's the only thing it is, or that after the Emmanuel killings, we all came together and everything was fine. We held hands on a bridge and it's fine now.
Right.
I worry about not telling the whole story about how people are really doing and who's still left out and what we haven't addressed. And it makes me nervous when we're not being honest about the full story.
I think too many people probably either saw Gone with the Wind or either read Gone with the Wind, and they've haven't managed to shake that one. So I'm going to stay in the storytelling and narrative facet for a bit more in light of the recent remake of Roots and the Jackie Robinson series on PBS and Henry Louis Gates Jr. and his exploration of African-American stories. I vividly recall the original airing of Roots in the 1970s. I was a teenager, and it was a cultural event like no other. It was experienced by virtually everyone, whether they watched mm-hmm. it or not. It was so out there that you couldn't. It was not like today. There were only three channels and.
And right. I remember
most people were watching it, and the idea that the blacks who lived nearby and actually went to school with me and who had this event of slavery in their background, even as close as their great grandparents at that time, held a certain profound realization for me. And it was a moment when the civil rights movement was still quite fresh. There was still segregation in many places, and the humanity of the series actually sort of built upon or coincided too with a pretty remarkable period of situation comedies that featured mm-hmm. African-American families, Sanford and Son, mm-hmm. the Jeffersons, right. Good Times. So it was a time when there was exposure to, you know, the early Sesame Street that whole kind of, you know, we're going to live together, the Big Blue Marble and Zoom. And so then we've sort of gone through this other period of kind of not too much attention to this matter, I suppose. And then when we, and I don't think I'm the first to say this, we come to the election of Barack Obama, and somehow the inequities in the system, we somehow think that all the inequities are solved. You know, that there's been enough distance that it's just not an issue anymore. But that's obviously not the case, as we've come to realize so markedly in recent years. And if anything, it's appeared to heighten the stereotypical issues of race and fear that have been used throughout our nation's history, really to divide us. I mean, it's almost as though this election of an African-American as president is become the sort of most divisive sort of moment in time. And I suppose this is just a question. Did you ever mm-hmm. think did you ever think, oh, well, we're living in a post-racial world?
That, you know, that's an easy question to answer. No, no, I didn't. But it also has to do with my own geography and my coming to consciousness. So,
right.
When I was in kindergarten in Hawaii, there was no ethnic majority. Again, I mean, there might have been a couple of white kids in my class, but it was Hawaiian kids, Japanese, Chinese, Samoan, Filipino, white kid, everybody, which is what I knew. That was my world. And so that is not to say that there are not significant racial and ethnic tensions in Hawaii. There are. But when you're in kindergarten, you don't know that. And you just know everybody, and there are all kinds of people. Well, then my parents moved us back to Texas, you know, against my will. But when you're seven, what can you do? So they took us back to Texas and put me in school, in a good school, you know, quote unquote.
Quote unquote.
And they were doing their best, as parents try to do. And they were very progressive people, but they put me in a good school. And everybody was white. And I had never been in a situation like that in my life. And I felt a tremendous sense of grief.
Right.
I felt the loss. Mm-hmm. And I've really felt it ever since. Because everywhere I've been ever since has been segregated in that way. Every city I've lived in, churches I've been a part of, neighborhoods, they're homogenous in a way that feels...
out of balance.
And there is a sadness because there's some richness, there's diversity, there's texture that's missing. And it's not as interesting, it's not as intelligent, it's not as engaging, it's less. And I think I've always felt that. I mean, the funny way my parents put it is when I came home from grade school in Texas, I asked them where everybody else was.
Nice.
Because I knew everybody else was somewhere,
right?
But they weren't in my class. And I still have that question, you know.
Oh, that's excellent. That's excellent. Well, I guess one of the real questions has to do with trying to bring these people together, which kind of puts us back into the bridge mode. I listened to the lecture that Eddie Glaude gave at, did I pronounce that
Glaude
correctly? Glaude. He did a lecture one Saturday afternoon a couple of weeks ago at Circular Church, as a matter of fact. And one of the things he mentioned was this, the values gap that separates us. And I have to say that after reading several articles in The Atlantic and the book Between the World and Me, author Ta-Nehisi Coates makes the possibility of empathy that I would see as a way of closing this gap seems so remote, so insurmountable. And how can we possibly understand what it means to be black? And I suppose that's one of the biggest questions facing us today. And I maybe it's not a question that we should really sort of feel like we need an answer for. I mean, but I guess the question for you is do you sense that there's a way that we can really move forward and slay this dragon?
I do. I'm a little bit like Eddie Glaude. I'm not an optimist or a pessimist. He would describe himself as a meliorist, trying to address the situation we're in. I think it's possible. I just think the work is so difficult because that value gap, I think, is external and it's internal. And just quickly, by that I mean it's external. You can see it in our geography. You can see which schools are underfunded. You can see which neighborhoods are not invested in. You can see, you know, and you can see which ones are. So when Eddie Glaude talks about the value gap, just to be clear, he means our founding contradiction that white people were valued more than anybody else. And certainly white men valued more than women, of course valued more than black or brown people and their bodies, which were sold. So he talks about, it's a fundamental contradiction. We've never addressed it adequately. So, and we continue to value certain people over others. That carries over. And you can see that in any city. I also think it's internal. We internalize that. I think white and black people both internalize it in the way we think and look at each other, and it's insidious. So the kind of work it takes, I think, and I'll speak as a white person and kind of to white people, although not for all white people, I think it requires a kind of spirituality that makes itself very vulnerable. Because listening to Glaude, listening to Coates, who is extraordinary, I think we need to sort of let our guard down and just listen and just let our hearts be broken by the kinds of things our brothers and sisters live with and by the way our country has treated them and the way the current arrangement continues to treat them. And I think it requires an incredible softness. I think white people especially, or people who are privileged in certain ways, or need to allow our hearts to be broken, honestly, and not be defensive about that, just go, oh my God, you know, and just listen and just bear witness. And it's from that place of softness, which I then think is a real place of love, that we can start to address the real problems, you know, which are structural and systemic, and there's a lifetime of work, and we won't see the end of it. So we have to work out of love for other people. Otherwise, we'll, you know, if we have to control the project, forget it. It's bigger than we are.
Well, that was an interesting thing. I keep up. I read this Brain Pickings blog by Maria Popova, which you may be familiar with. And she was recently talking about cynicism, and that one of the things that we have a tendency to do is compete, you know, that we're going to, one of us, somebody's going to win and somebody's going to lose. And that sort of competitiveness is really destructive, and sort of the losing side sort of, are those who are forced to kind of fit into the lose mold, become cynical or feel helpless and, you know, feel worthless. I mean, that there's, you know, that at some point we probably need to shed this sort of sense that everything is a competition.
Right.
You know, that everything is about winning or lose, you know, that you got to win at all costs. And therefore there have to be losers. And I think that kind of fits in, with, you know, our tendency to sort of seek competitiveness and all, really has that ability to kind of undermine some of those empathy and the sort of ways that we can connect and really sort of show love and, you know, that reaching out kind of thing. I mean, even things that, you know, the Olympic spirit is supposed to be about sportsmanship, right? And it became about in the 80s, you know, the USA
right,
chant,
right.
that seemed to be sort of on their surface, maybe healthy and patriotic or whatever, but on the other hand, kind of destructive in terms of, you know, that everybody's just there to compete. Some people were there, you know, just the honor, just being there is enough.
Right.
For so many of those competitors.
And it reminds me, I mean, I think there's an individualism embedded in that competitive attitude, that is my team or it's my country or it's my performance or it's what. And I think the individualism also makes us sick. You know, it's
right.
that what we're hoping for is a more, we're trying to transcend ego in some way and think about the whole community, that my life is not just about me or my family.
Right.
It's about my city and my community. And we're terrible at this, I think, in this country, honestly. It's about the seven generations from now. It's about my relatives I won't ever know.
Right.
And what I pass to them. But I think the individualism, that also is, gosh, we've got some work to do, you know, on that.
Well, I did. I read something just a few days ago, and they were talking about the tendency culturally. We've become quite obsessed with our role as a taxpayer, and we've lost our responsibility as citizens.
Right.
That we've sort of obsessed about the me, the taxpayer, which, you know, is that element that drives a wedge between everyone, and those people that are, you know, those of us who sort of are the citizenry, you know, that those are the, that's the aspect of our culture that could actually bring us together. And I did think, and they were, you know, they were talking specifically about education, about the funding of education, that this kind of debate about taxpayer versus citizen, it's like, you know, this is not a, we can't, we don't want to lose this one.
right. Well, and taxpayer is so reductive. I mean, I actually am, maybe this is countercultural. I like pitching in for the common good. So it's, it doesn't all have to be for my kid or for my neighborhood, but there's a common good. You know, I mean, sure, we want to spend money wisely and make good investments. Great. But, you know, I drive on publicly funded roads. My kid goes to a publicly funded school. We use the library. We call the fire department, you know. And just thinking of that in terms of taxes, I think, is a really small way of thinking about it.
It is a small way of thinking about it. And I do think that it brings about, it goes back to your point of getting different opinions, making sure that everybody's at the table, because it's a richer experience that if we're only looking at our own personal needs, are the that we're defining the community in terms of those of us who are alike, rather than all of us, then we really are missing an opportunity for richness and discourse that can be engaging and really quite wonderful. And I suppose this kind of brings up this question. I mean, you really have sort of explored the circuit connections for yourself, kind of on behalf of others, I suppose, in seeking partnerships within the African American community. And I know from my own experience that if you were mayor.com, that there's always a bit of suspicion, you know, when you're sort of asking people to kind of share. So how do you overcome that? I mean, and it's okay if it's like, oh, it takes a lot of work and.
Right. Well, you're right. So, I think the way to build trust and relationships is by just sort of being real with each other and working together over time. And I don't think there's any substitute for that. And when you sort of stick up for everybody and stay in it, people will notice that. I mean, and maybe it's as simple as if you really love other people, they'll figure it out, you know. and that love will keep you engaged. And if you're if we're unpretentious and if we're a little vulnerable, we're, you know, not defensive, we're really listening, we're really joining in causes, we're not trying to necessarily take control, but just to be a part, you know, one among many.
Right.
And I think when we do come with that genuinely communal attitude, and sure, we want to share our points of view and things like that, but we know it's not only about us. And certainly understanding that historically and currently, white people have had an outsized role, have had more than enough privilege. So creating spaces where more voices can be heard and savoring that. I don't know. I think most of it is just if we really love others, they'll know.
I like that word, savor. I mean, I like the idea of savoring the opinions of other people. I mean, that's really a very cool way of you know, finding joy in what others have to offer.
Let me carry that just one step further, because this really is important. I think also finding joy in the struggle, because it's got to be a sustained effort. We can't just show up with the black community, for example, and hold hands on a bridge and say we feel bad and then expect that'll do it. It really has to be school board meetings and city council. It has to be the hard things, that committees in church basements or in ILA halls or need a commitment to things that people really need and that our whole community needs. And then over time, you show up enough and keep showing up when it's hard and when you lose and you come back and, you know, we find ways to renew ourselves and stay in it. But we've got to find joy in that. And for me, part of that is just the real relationships that develop. That there's a joy in that. And but I don't want to gloss over the hard work part.
No, of course not.
It's unending, I think.
Well, and I do know that part of the work you've done has been to sort of bring about a kind of collaboration, because it seems important to keep the conversations inclusive and with different ideas on the table. I mean, some people have different ideas. There was a big article about the fundraising process that they've been doing for the National African American Museum in Washington, D.C. and the numbers of people that had never been asked for money on anything sort of stepping up and saying, oh, somebody asked me to do something. I mean, it was sort of, it was like the entire African American community had been sort of left out of so many of those processes, and they really felt this compulsion to take ownership of that, and I thought it was really cool. I mean, it was a really nice thing, but I do know that that sort of leads me to this other question about sort of, I know that some people are a little weary of the talk, and you hear it in some of the conversations. You know, can we have some action? I mean, you've the frustration, the sort of visible frustration within some of these communities that
right.
We've always been talking, and one of the purposes of if you were mayor is not just to talk or put forth ideas, but to really sort of see if we can push those things along and find ways for those things to initiate action, and it's important to be positive.
Right.
We've basically said, you know, if you have negative comments, they're gone. They won't make it through. Do you have a few thoughts maybe on some additional steps that can foster some real actionable change maybe in our community?
I think you know, one thing I think getting involved in groups that are actually organized and effective. So for me, one of those groups is the Charleston Area Justice Ministry. It's not the only one, and it's not a perfect one. We're still working out the model, and we're still working out how to do it best. We're about 4 years old, and we've made some really good progress in terms of policy, in terms of concrete results, and we've had other failures. So it requires, you know, that kind of resilience and go back and critique and make it better and keep working. So I think one of the keys is just to find groups that, you know, with whom the mission resonates with you and getting involved. This is very mundane in a sense, just over time. Find, you know, Charleston Moves or Quality Education Project or Metanoia, or there's so many groups.
Right.
And getting involved in things that just slowly move us ahead. The other thing I would say, and this comes from a guy named Al Rabiteau, he's sort of a legendary African-American historian who's now retired from Princeton. But he was talking about this. We were in a conversation, and he just asked very plainly, an entire room full of people, when was the last time you had dinner with someone of a different race than your own? And he just asked us to sort of answer that internally. And that's an incredible challenge, I think. So building those relationships too, I think, carry things forward. I think there's no way to do it other than relationally. So that's an incomplete answer. There's still more to be said, but
it's
that's
the kinds
where
of things
begin.
It's the kinds of things to build trust. I mean, mm-hmm. This is the same things you do with your own friends.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's basically saying don't treat those who are maybe physically different than you the way you would treat your own friends, and you'll build the kinds of trust that can mend some of the fences that have been torn, you know,
right.
Or tear down some of the fences, I suppose. Right. And
again, to go into those moments with vulnerability and and a sincere curiosity. So I'm very boring. I'm a straight white guy, you know, Christian. It's completely boring, but
you do like baseball.
I do like baseball. That's also somewhat conventional, but entering in, you know, it being in relationship, having friends and family members and community who are different races, different genders, different ages, different religions, different sexual orientations. This is wonderful. I learn things that I could never learn on my own. I get all these experiences, all this wisdom that I could never access. And I'm genuinely curious and grateful for that. So I think that's also helpful, you know, to go into those conversations thinking, wow, you know, there's so much more wisdom than any of us could get just through our own limited view. And so that's a beautiful thing when we get to it. And having said that, we need to give ourselves permission to be clumsy and to make mistakes, to sort of embarrass ourselves, because there are differences and they're real. And as we learn about them, there's some humor in it. There is a little bit of clumsiness, and we go, okay.
Right. Well, this wouldn't be the show if I didn't sort of end with the ultimate question. What would you do if you were mayor?
If I were mayor, and you know, it's funny, the first thing that jumps to mind is I would call Michelle Mapp. I mean, really. And I would ask for help. So, and for those who may or may not know, Michelle Mapp is so involved in community investment and in investing in parts of our community that have never been invested in. And I would ask her, how can we make this a city for everybody and bring back that real texture? I would be looking to peel back gentrification and make this a peninsula that wasn't just for tourists, wasn't just a great place to come have a 4-star meal, but it was a great place to live, where every kind of person could live. And I would probably be an unpopular mayor. I don't know. I would be stirring that up, saying, how can we regain a whole community and not just
the voices of those who sort of shout the loudest, I guess.
Right. And or those with the most capital.
Right.
You know, those with the most influence. I'd want it. Charleston is much more interesting than that. And the Charleston that we know, I think the greater Charleston, is extraordinary. It's cultural resources. It's ethnic resources. It's the stories that we can tell that mostly haven't been told. Not the postcard carriage stories.
Right.
But I mean, we're starting to tell them, I think, in certain ways. But the resistance stories, the history of struggle, and the freedom stories that we can draw from this place are amazing. So if I were mayor, I'd call Michelle Mapp. And then I'd also, after thinking about the human work that's to be done, I also have real concerns about our impact on the environment here and where we're building and how we're building, and with regard to the marshes and the barrier islands and some of the things that make this biologically an extraordinary place to live. That doesn't mean I wouldn't develop or I don't want people to move here. I moved here. But I'd want to use a lot more care than I think we're currently using. And this is just me, but I would send the cruise ships back up to the Navy base and make them plug in because the air we breathe really matters too. So.
It does matter. It does matter. Well, I just want to thank you so much, Jeremy, for coming in and talking with me. You're doing great work. I just stand in astonishment, and I'm so glad you're here. And I'm really glad that you took the time out of your very busy schedule, and that this opportunity to share with the audience how important it is to develop an understanding and appreciation for those who are different than we are. And I appreciate your sort of bringing up some very, very, very important points that are thoughtful and sincere. And I know that making this leap is going to be a huge step for all of us. So thank you. That wraps up this segment of Small Talks, Big Ideas with If You Were Mayor.
Thank you.
And again, we invite you to go online to our Facebook page and submit your questions, feedback, and ideas for this segment. We'll post a link to the full to this broadcast on our website, and we'll distribute that for anyone who might miss its regular or want to hear it again, I should say. So next week, tune in to Small Talks, Big Ideas for your chance to hear from Low Country Local First about something homegrown. Thank you for tuning in to 96.3 FM Ohm Radio Charleston and supporting your local nonprofit radio station.